Hey, you listening to Deconstructor, a fun podcast again? Okay, well, we got some good stuff for you. Today, the hosts are, well, as always, doing the 14 episodes of before, myself, Mishka Katkoff, and Joseph Kim. We got Eric Kress returning 3 episodes now in a row. Eric is a heavy hitter when it comes to corporate strategy, capital markets research, business development, investment banking. So he has a lot of good stuff for you. And we are talking today about Glu Mobile. And more precisely, we're talking about 2 key articles and 2 key pieces. And that one is, you know, first of all, we're going to talk about the transformation that has been happening since Nick Earl took over. And then we're going to talk about the recent stock price plunge that occurred and whether that is something that the decline will continue during 2019 or whether it's something that Glu is going to bounce back from. So a lot of interesting pieces on that. As always, please do leave a comment. We have plenty of comments coming from you, especially feedback on how we can improve. A few of the people were asking about timestamps. That's not going to happen, too much work. But but a few of you were also asking for links to the articles that we are deconstructing. And now the links have been added in the description of this episode. So please go ahead, click through and enjoy those ones. And as always, please do leave more comments. Please rate this podcast. And please subscribe on whatever podcasting platform you're using for listening this one. That's all. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Twig 14. In this podcast, we're actually going to cover 2 articles today. The first actually goes back to an article posted in February 25th, so much earlier this year, that talks about Glu's redesign in terms of its headquarters and its strategy. And then more recently in October, there was an article that posted about Glu's stock plunging, and we'll talk about some of the potential reasons why the stock has gone down since then. But ahead of that, I think, and today we have our now becoming a regular guest, Eric Kress, with us today. And I think, Eric, you wanted to make a few comments before we started, correct?
Yeah, I wanted to make a quick correction regarding the Zynga podcast, the last one. You know, I characterize Bloomberg as a non-reliable source, which is actually very incorrect. It is considered a very reputable source. And I think what likely happened with the leak of interest in Zynga is generally when companies get unsolicited bids from a third party, the company or its bankers could leak that info to the press in order to see if there was any additional interest in the company. I mean, we did this strategy when I was back at Montgomery, and you know, this is a really typical strategy for bankers, basically to start an informal process as opposed to a formal process to sell the company. And I still think that the deal is not likely and that Frank and the board feel that they can build more shareholder value as a standalone company. But again, as we all know, everything is for sale at the right price. But I just want to make that clarification. Thanks.
Great. So today, again, we'll be doing a deep dive in terms of Glu. And let's start with a brief recap or a brief article brief of the first article, which is Glu Mobile redesigns its headquarters and its strategy. And basically, this article talks about how Glu back in February of this year moved into a brand new headquarters in San Francisco. So most of the staff is now under one roof. And in terms of the fourth quarter financials from the 2017 fourth quarter financials, revenue was up. So up 73% from a year earlier, up to $80.2 million, with a net loss of $39.5 million compared to $17.2 million from a year earlier. And the biggest change was a change in management. So they have a new CEO, Nick Earl, who replaced his longtime boss, Niccolo DeMasi. And the company's, from an employee perspective, was down in February to 548 employees from a peak of 850 from a couple of years ago. And so VentureBeat interviews Nick Earl and their chief revenue officer, Chris Akhavan, who talk about their new strategy. And essentially, some of the key points from the article state that, for example, they put a lot of their teams and co-located them together. So three of their five studios are now in that new headquarters in SF, with the remaining two studios, one being in San Mateo doing sports and the other, the Hollywood Group in Toronto. And one of the quotes that was mentioned is they wanted to reduce logistical and structural complexity, and they were trying to get rid of the rest. They also admitted the celebrity model was not working out for them, except for Kim Kardashian. And so some of the other bets in terms of Katy Perry, Britney, and Nicki just basically didn't work out. And one of the quotes from Nick Earl was that social following should have lightened that cost of advertisement. And to that strategy, he said it was very understandable how Niccolo led that. So kind of, I thought that quote was a little bit funny. But anyway, Akhavan then talks about their revised product strategy, which basically was around trying to find strong creative leaders and focusing more on great prototypes. So Akhavan also states that before they weren't doing a lot of prototypes, and they were launching products before they were ready. They then also talk about emulating Supercell, not all parts of Supercell, because they admit that no one can be Supercell except Supercell, but some of the aspects of the Supercell culture, like, you know, transparency and honesty, having an egoless culture, and similar to Ilka, having their CEO be sort of the least powerful CEO and delegating to product teams. Nick Earl then mentions, you know, a big change in terms of being able to kill off more products without having to launch products even before they're ready or if they're not right. And so again, Nick then talks about how, you know, at some companies such as EA that, you know, they weren't able to kill products, or they had to launch stuff just based on the culture and the structure there. Nick Earl then talks about the creative leadership aspect, and he talks about bringing in a key creative leader named Mike Olson, who basically was, you know, he claims to be responsible for turning Tiger Woods Golf from a 20 million year business to a 130 million year business, and who also worked on The Godfather and also led Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes. There were other interesting tidbits. They talk about Machine Zone and how Machine Zone fell down because people burned out and they lost a couple of key clans, which I thought was an interesting simplification of what happened at Machine Zone. And then probably the other key point was around this notion of going lateral, but not about not going lateral, but going deep. So as an example, they talk about Kim Kardashian and then just trying to churn out a bunch of reskins of Kim Kardashian, rather than doing sort of the Kabam strategy with Contest of Champions, which is to like take a game and just really deepen the monetization and make it as deep as possible. So, okay, so just in quick recap, it sounds like the strategy, if I'm understanding this correctly, and Mishka and Eric, please correct me if you saw something else, but one, sounded like they wanted to simplify the org structure, focus on bigger hits. They wanted to actually figure out game design before they started working on production, focus on more game prototypes. They wanted to bet on key creative leaders like Mike Olson. They wanted to emulate Supercell culture, and they wanted to go deep, not lateral. So Mishka and Eric, what do you guys think? Did I capture that correctly? And do you think this makes sense?
I want to just state one thing. I don't know how, but they got so much space on TechCrunch. This article was literally 8 pages. Like it was, I'm not hating on it at all. It was really interesting to read, but it was the longest article I've ever seen on TechCrunch. Like you would assume machine learning or AI would get this much space, but Glue was able. So props to whoever is heading their communication, because they have the best relationships with TechCrunch. So that's, and I will link this article in this podcast description, so you can marvel at everything and just read through it. But it is as much space anybody has ever gotten on TechCrunch. So that's my first take.
But yeah. Eric, do you have any thoughts?
You know, I'm going to go into it a little bit more a little bit later in terms of kind of their overall view. But the strategy of creating development teams under one roof in San Francisco seems at odds with almost every other strategy that I've seen in the business. Everyone knows how expensive it is in San Francisco, competition or talent. it seems much more, makes much more sense to create a city-state model in more low-cost areas. That's the one thing that stands out to me.
Right. I totally agree with you. And when we talked about Zynga during the last Twig podcast, we mentioned that R&D for other companies outside of the U.S., companies that are here in San Francisco, like Zynga and Glu, was 30 to 50% lower. So Rovio, Gung-Ho, Nexon, it's like, you know, the R&D as a percentage of revenue is like, you know, 20% relative to 10%. And on top of that, I think that, you know, sales and marketing, clearly, you know, a higher percentage of revenue as well. And then culturally, I just feel like you've got great, like, PMs and probably UA folks in the San Francisco Bay Area, but there's definitely kind of a mercenary culture here, and certain types of functions, like game designers, for example, I think are much better in other areas of the world. But
well,
yeah,
I can counter that. I mean, I've, you know, just like you, Joe, I've run a studio in San Francisco, and I worked in San Francisco for over 4 years, running game teams. And I have to say that the talent you can get, you know, you can get in Bay Area is excellent. And of course, it costs more. But at the same time, you know, I'm running a studio here in Helsinki now. So it's not, you know, it's not cheap. Of course, it's much cheaper when it comes to the personnel costs. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of other type of costs that you have when you're running a studio in Europe. You know, the social costs and whatnot, they're pretty high, and they're hidden away from the salary. So when it comes to overall the cost of the team, I would say that San Francisco can be, you know, shipping a game would probably take you twice the money on a good team. So if it would take, you know, between $1.5 to $3 million to ship a game here, like a normal, we're not talking about, you know, crazy production values, but a, you know, an average game. Just if you can say an average game, that would be an average game. Then in SF, it would start from $3 million, and it would be probably close. I mean, it can get up to $20 million if you're at EA or anywhere else where you have teams of 50. But at the same time, you know, you get good talent. You can't argue that. The engineers are phenomenal. The people are really hungry, and most of the people are quite young in the sense that they don't have family and they work super hard. So that's definitely a big pro that you don't get in these more cozy areas of game development.
Okay, yeah.
I would make one more argument. I think the risk of being part of, like, you know, the head of the company, you know, in the belly of the beast is what I always called it, is that creative people just can't be creative. Like, they can't do their own thing and have the flexibility of thinking outside the box because they're constantly being looked over the shoulder by management. And we saw that at EA, we saw that at Kabam to some degree, is that the kind of the underperforming studios were Redwood Shores in San Francisco. And I just worry that, first of all, Glu can't afford to make mistakes if it costs, you know, between 1.5 and 2 times to make games in San Francisco. And I just worry that they're not going to be able to have the flexibility to build creative experiences that will actually, you know, do well in the marketplace.
I second Eric 100% on that. I worked in companies in multiple times where I was in the HQ and when I was away from the HQ and in one of those satellite studios. And it's a ground rule that the satellite studios are just better performing. And I think there's this thing of, like, being afraid of the management. But I would say another thing is the different type of fear. And that is fear of getting cut. Because if you're a studio somewhere, let's say Helsinki, you're so far away from the management. So if you're not delivering, they will cut you. But at the same time, if you're a team close to the management, you know, it's they're the boys around here, so they're not going to cut them first. So that's kind of like my view. So the guys further away, you know, several time zones away, are the ones who are trying harder.
Okay, so sounds like in terms of some of the other strategic initiatives that were mentioned by Nick Earl and Chris Akavon, sounds like we think that those are, you know, probably right. And then there's some controversy here in terms of the focus on San Francisco. I personally don't like it, but, you know, it definitely, you know, a debatable topic for sure.
So how about if we talk about this sort of a supercell structure? And then when we're talking about the supercell structure, we're talking essentially about investing into something without any you know, any guarantees that something is going to come out. There's no ton of decks on them like, hey, we looked at the market and we see that, but we should go here because we're going to improve this or we can improve that. It's more of a, we trust this team. They came up with a good idea. It's an interesting idea. They have a great prototype. Let's invest time into that and see what's going to come out. And because when you're trying to make something new, when you're trying to make something genre defining, the biggest problem is not just the idea. The idea can be cool, but the actual execution, because there's so many minor steps, everything from the UX to design to the balancing, there will be huge hurdles along from the prototype to pre-production to production. And those are the ones that really cause the risk of never finishing the product. And that's why, you know, that's why Supercell is not known for shipping ton of games, because all the games are very aspirational, very difficult to finish. So right. That is a very, very interesting strategy for a public company. And then the article, Chris and Nick, they talk a lot about how they're financially set because, you know, let's be honest, their overall revenue is up by 20% year to year. Design Home is really steady. It has grown 60% last year alone. They got their, you know, their one-off reoccurring hits, everything from MLB to do they have other Tap sports games? I think MLB is the one. They used to have the Tap football, but the Tap studio in San Mateo is you know, turning out great games, well monetizing. And then they even have this Kim Kardashian still bringing tons of revenue out of I believe it's run from Bangalore or I think they have some other India location. Maybe not Bangalore. It
might be Hyderabad.
Hyderabad. Yeah, Hyderabad. Yeah, that's the one. So they have they're talking about that they have this, you know, solid portfolio where they can take risks, and then they are taking these risks. And I think, you know, I think it's really interesting. I think it's what all the game developers want. That every time you talk to anybody, they're talking like they want to work just like Supercell works. But at the same time, it's just really interesting. I don't know. What do you think about this approach?
I mean, I agree with you. I think that, you know, it takes, you know, deep pockets and a lot of patience to like keep continuing to work on, you know, taking this longer term bet on coming up with a, you know, really massive hit. And it also takes the right creative team. And so like making these longer term bets and making sure that you've got the right team working against those bets, because, you know, it could just be that you're working with a team that's not good and you're just, you know, giving them a long time to make a hit. Whereas, you know, you look at some of the bigger hits that we've had, whether it's Hearthstone, which took 6+ years, and Fortnite, which took 6+ years, and then a lucky pivot to, you know, Battle Royale, that
Roblox, you know, and everything.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, I feel sorry for the company that bets on a team that's actually not the right team for like 6 years, like, oh, oops, we made a really huge mistake. But, you know, and I think just to be fair, Chris and Nick didn't say that they were going to try to emulate all parts of the Supercell culture. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
they would make themselves obsolete if they would.
Yeah.
Well, the Supercell also had the advantage of making almost over $1 billion a year and having and like 250 to 300 people, and they had the flexibility of prototyping and killing and prototyping and killing because they just had all this revenue, constant revenue stream, being supported by UA and marketing, et cetera, et cetera. They just Glue just doesn't have that. You know, they have one product.
And right? Eric is definitely hitting the point, because when developers, when other companies are talking about the Supercell model, they kind of ignore the beginning of Supercell, like what happened to the years before Supercell became Supercell. Right. You know, there was the game, there was the Gunshine game, there was the couple of studios, the one studio that they had around here, you know, making the first mobile games. The fact that they were running out of money, the lucky fact that they pivoted at the right time from browser to tablet, which then grew up significantly, and the fact that the first two games that were massive hits, Heyday and Clash of Clans. Well, you know, especially Clash of Clans, it wasn't that new, if you know what I mean. Like, there are some games that were pretty good benchmarks for it. So the design at that point and the approach at that point was smart. It was, you know, it was looking at the market, it was looking at what makes the sense, and it was really looking at the clock, because you don't have indefinitely time where you're not making money. You have 6 months to ship a game. What are you going to do? We have to make money. Go. And then that pressure, you know, created diamonds, and the company has, you know, soared ever since. And of course,
during these years, the approach has changed because when you have so much cash, it allows you to be so much more creative and take so many more risks. And as we've seen, Clash of Clans is going nowhere. The game is still growing. It's gigantic. Heyday hasn't probably gotten an ounce of marketing for the last 5 years. And that game makes, what, probably $150 million a year with a team of, I don't know, maybe five or seven. So they are in a phenomenal position. And of course, that gives so much more safety to kill 100 games. They can be killing games for the next 100 years, and there will be still money in the bank. So, you know.
Yeah, definitely a good point, Eric. And the other examples that I mentioned, whether it was Hearthstone with Blizzard or, you know, Epic with Fortnite, those companies were in a position where, you know, they didn't have to rush the product out. So 100% agreed in terms of that point. Okay, should we move on to the next article?
We can move on to the next article, but all I want to say, like, towards the end is just I do appreciate the model that Glue is taking. I think which article are we moving, by the way?
So we're moving on to the article about Glue's stock and looking at why the stock plunged on October 8th.
Got it. Okay. So yeah, so all I want to say about this model, I think it's really interesting because at the same time, even though it sounds crazy, it also sounds like a game developer's dream. Like, oh my God, I can just prototype. We have all these resources. The management is not breathing up my neck. I can work with the most talented people because the size of the teams, you know, as Nick was describing in the article, is about, you know, to 15 to 20, even at max. And it sounds great because you have everything set up. You have this new beautiful studio. You know, it sounds great. It sounds great. So I think it could work. It could work if they can acquire the right type of talent. And of course, Mike Olson is a super smart guy, has a history of hits and has been a game maker for probably like 20, 25 years. So more people like that, they can create great teams and they can take those risks. And eventually, I do believe that if you have a great team and you have that flexibility and freedom to take risks, you will succeed. I mean, that's,
you know,
that's
you're speaking like a true studio person, and you're basically a CFO nightmare.
that's what I am, and I'm not a CFO's nightmare. I look at the bottom line. Come on, CFOs like me, but but at the same time, you know, you can't. It's just like what's your appetite for the risk? And it feels like Glue's appetite for the risk is quite significant at this moment. Because they do have that Tap Sports studio, they do have the CrowdStar, they do have the Toronto and the Hyderabad that are kind of like working on the low risk stuff. So why not? I mean, I hope they succeed.
Okay. So moving on to the next article. This was an article by The Motley Fool, and it was published on October 8th. And the article is titled "Why Glue Mobile Inc. Stock Plunged Today." And essentially what happened is that Roth Capital, an investment bank, downgraded the stock to neutral from buy. And it actually fell quite a bit. So it went from over $7.50 per share on October 3rd and then dropped to $6.31. And today it's sitting still at less than $6, which is against a market cap of about $820 million. And just to be clear, you know, in terms of this podcast, we don't care so much about short-term stock price fluctuations, but, you know, rather we want to just talk about the higher level macro trends or how the market is potentially interpreting Glue's strategy or how Glue is doing. And since that first article that we talked about, you know, shares have soared. So year to date, like 98%. And primarily off of some of the key titles like Design Home, Tap Sports, Deer Hunter, and Cooking Dash. And so, you know, that was the gist of the article, but a few key points in terms of, you know, it's strange why the stock dropped and why all of a sudden, you know, Roth, for example, downgraded the stock, because essentially the rationale that was given for downgrading the stock is that there was essentially no new news that the stock has gone up a lot and there was a lack of additional catalyst. So clearly it seems the market had interpreted the new strategy and new management team favorably from the beginning of the year. But now it sounds like there's a little bit of, you know, hesitation or confidence in Glue. So with that, Eric, I know you in particular are very familiar with Glue. It'd be great if you could drop some knowledge on us in terms of how we should interpret what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, Roth Capital's downgrade is kind of is interesting because it basically claims there's no near-term catalyst for the company. And I agree. Like, there's no new games that are coming out that are going to help move the needle. And you know, a lot of the stock movement is likely on momentum because stock market was going up. And now we're actually seeing some weakness across the tech sector in general. So they're starting to lose even more market share. And I guess what I would start with is I kind of consider Glu a really struggling company that had did an amazing acquisition, right? That's kind of where they're at right now. The former CEO, Niccolo, got Crowdcast for super cheap. I consider it like the second best acquisition in the mobile space to date from a value perspective, after Playdemic, you know, Golf Clash that Warner bought. I mean, that was an amazing acquisition. You know, Crowdcast was acquired by Glu based on Covet Fashion's revenues and for about $45 million with some earn out, I believe, and with the promise of Design Home. Since that time, Design Home has made over $130 million, and it is on track to be the biggest title ever for Glu, you know. So that's what's driving the majority of their upside right now is this acquisition done by Niccolo, which was great, phenomenal. You know, historically, Glu has had these boom bust cycles twice before. It was first with Deer Hunter early in the mobile cycle, and then with Kardashian. With Deer Hunter, they became a prolific developer of some sniper based games, and they made a million different sniper based games. Each one did worse than the last, right? And then in the Kardashian time, they built tons of celebrity games, you know, Nicki Minaj, Taylor Swift, Katy Perry, et cetera, which Kardashian was the only one that did really well. The rest of them were kind of train wrecks, right? So each time the company saw some success, but they struggled to replicate that success with subsequent launches. And the stock dipped wild, you know, rose to like $6 to $7, $8, and then went right back down to $3 to $4. You know, I think we're kind of in the midst of a third cycle. The only difference here is that they're not really iterating on Design Home. And Nick, you know, the new CEO, to his credit, is really supporting Design Home with tons of UA, tons of resources to support live services, content updates, and et cetera. And they're doing a really good job of supporting that game. But there are some real fundamental issues with Glu that I think are behind the scenes, you know, in terms of, you know, issues with the company and why I think they're struggling that kind of need to be addressed. Right. And so the one is what we talked about before is the San Francisco office doesn't make any sense to me. I think a lot of the success in mobile, even at EA, was SimCity in Helsinki, Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes from the Sacramento team. And I know anybody who's listening that actually worked on that team knows that that was not a smooth operation, but yet they were allowed to actually do what they needed to do to make a successful game. And it's by far the most successful game EA has ever made in mobile. I also think that we're starting to see some weakness on Design Home. You know, Design Home Tap Baseball kind of represents 70% of the revenue over the last couple of months. Majority of their products are just not really delivering all that much. And Design Home, we're starting to see like they're pumping in more and more, you know, the same amount of downloads every month, but revenue is flatline for the last three or four months. And it looks like if I were to guess that this, we should see declines in revenue from Design Home at the beginning of next year. So again, when Design Home starts to decline, they really have nothing left to offset. And that comes to their pipeline. So I think personally, and from what I've heard anecdotally, is that their overall game development capacity is very low, right? They've lost a lot of people. They've lost a lot of teams, you know, and they went, you know, from that 850 to 450 type people. The majority of those people were developers. The two games they have in development that where they were talked about in the earnings call was Titan World and WWE Universe, both of which are in beta. Titan World looks like the metrics were so horrendous. I mean, it just was not a well-designed game. And so it looks like they removed that completely from the store, as far as I can tell. WWE Universe is actually a pretty good game. I think it's kind of the right idea. But the problem with WWE as a franchise or as a brand is that there's a gazillion games in the store and it's hard to stand out. And so far, the monetization looks absolutely terrible. So that's not going to really contribute as much as I think they'd hoped. And Disney Pixar game, it looks kind of far off. I'm not really clear as to what that is, but that's likely not coming out anytime soon. So in essence, what I see is that the comps are tough, right? I think Design Home did extremely well this year. Covet Fashion is holding in there. And Tap Baseball has also done quite well. But they have to replicate the success of Design Home next year. And I just don't think Design Home is going to hold up. And I don't think they have anything in the pipeline that's going to offset the weakness there. And, you know, maybe it's possible that they do another acquisition. I mean, I don't know how much cash or, you know, acquisition capability they have, you know, but can they really strike, like, you know, lightning twice? And, you know, we'll see what, you know, what Nick and the rest of the team can actually execute against. But I think they're in, it seems like they're in line for a very tough year next year, in my opinion.
Well, let me take a stab at it as well. So, you know, I was kind of looking at the portfolio. I can see the same things. Of course, Design Home, you know, bringing most of the revenue, but MLB was actually really great this year as well. And what you can see is, yes, I do agree that Design Home seems to be kind of tapped out at this moment. But at the same time, I was looking where the revenue was coming from. And most of the Glue games, like overall Glue's portfolio is generating 75% of revenue from US alone. So there's a ton of capacity to grow actually Design Home in other markets. That's what I personally believe. I'm not sure how it resonates in the Asia, but definitely in the Western audience, it resonates really well. It's really simple to follow and simple to play. So I kind of believe that there's space there, and maybe they will shift more of their installed and localization, culturalization towards the Western markets and European markets and other ones. The second part is the Kim Kardashian. It actually has phenomenal revenue to download ratio. So I'm not sure how much growth there is, but we can see that the growth happens every time when the season comes in. And I don't know, Kim Kardashian is probably on her 25th season already. God bless everybody who watches it. But that seems to be holding up. And so the one thing is the revenue. Everything is coming from the U.S. So if they can diversify the revenue sources, especially the countries, that will help out a lot. And the second part was the Disney that you mentioned. I'm not aware of what the IP is. They were talking about the Disney IPs, which pretty much covers half of the IPs in the world. But if it's a good IP, they should be able to create a decent game. Oh, and finally, I was looking at their downloads as well. Deer Hunter is bringing tons of downloads. Overall, all their franchises are bringing about 20% of all the downloads. And, you know, they haven't launched a new Deer Hunter game in a while. So I think there's a space in maybe creating Deer Hunter 2020. That could be a little bit better monetizing, because the previous versions had that CSR racing type of, you know, kind of low level monetization. So they do have some IPs that are in those niche categories, like the MLBs, like the hunting, like the not WWE, but other ones. So there's possible upside. I'm not seeing, you know, that they would start declining right away.
Yeah, got it. It seems like, you know, and from my perspective, it seems like if the strategy is to be more like Supercell, to work on a lot of prototypes, to like really focus on creating a super hit game, that a couple of things that, you know, Glue management is going to have to be wary of is that if Eric is right and like the current titles start to decline next year, but you're going to have to be more patient against this longer sort of development cycle, because you're prototyping a lot. You're you know, like, again, Hearthstone, Fortnite, those types of titles took a really long time to get to market. And I think even, you know, Clash Royale was initially prototyped and they sat on it and they kind of improved it over time. So like, if that takes a long time, then I definitely think there's probably going to be a lot of pressure on this on the stock. And secondly, it's not clear if they're trying to go deeper rather than lateral, then at least what we're seeing from Modern Home, to Eric's point, we're not seeing this type of, you know, ARPDAU RP growth that you typically see from pro live ops teams that are able to, you know, significantly improve these products. So the question for me would be, do they have the expertise from a live ops perspective to continue to improve these games and make them deeper and make them longer lasting over time?
And I one more point about Design Home. I'm not going to argue. Design Home is like a category defining game. Like, it is a brand new experience that it was very unique. Yeah. And I know some of the CrowdStar guys, actually, you're good friends with one of the CrowdStar guys. But they did a phenomenal job of that game. But that game is a content treadmill. It's not as easy to maintain as something like Clash of Clans or even Game of War to some degree in terms of live ops. And you have to keep designing more and more content, you know, for, you know, that treadmill, right? And ultimately, you run out of content to build to some degree, or it just becomes less and less interesting. So there is a challenge from that perspective in terms of kind of user burnout from the game. But and we frankly, we haven't seen all that much competitions come up. We've seen the that puzzle game from Social Point, right? Anyway, that does that sort of thing. But I don't see much competition coming across. But
So I would say there is competition, but we have to look at it more as a customization or a lifestyle category. And when we look at the customization category, you can see Love Nikki, the Tencent version of Covet Fashion. That it's on this. It's on a crazy run, right? They have, I think, 15 different versions, but one of the versions is on par with Design Home in terms of revenue, sometimes even capping it. So when you look at Love Nikki, which is Covet Fashion on steroids, you can see a lot of innovation coming in and much more deeper monetization mechanics that come in through this immersive RPG gameplay. And they have everything from merging to evolution that happens through different pieces of clothing and so forth. So we have full deconstruction on Deconstructor of Fun of that game, but I would argue that there's ton of room to improve those games to double their ARPDAU at least. But we haven't seen that happening, which has been kind of surprising to me, because those games have been live for a while, and I would assume that they would have I don't want to say the balls, but the kind of like the need to innovate and improve and follow what Love Nikki has been doing. So, yeah.
Right. I want to underscore a point that Eric made earlier, but so if we kind of look at the timeline here in February, Nick Earl, new CEO, Nick and Chris Akhavan announced a new strategy. The stock's been going up. And so there's been like a finance or banker's narrative around Glue Management having executed a significant turnaround. But really, when you kind of look under the hood, when we see, to Eric's point before, in terms of how much of the revenue is from Design Home, I think about 30% of bookings. And then when you look at the impact of CrowdStar, which is Design Home plus Covet Fashion, was about 54% of Q1 bookings. So that's a majority of their revenue. Then you can kind of see that actually the current management is riding on the wave of the CrowdStar acquisition. And so what I think is going to be interesting to see here is to actually see what this current management under Nick Earl actually does against the strategy that they outlined. Will they be able to go deep instead of lateral? Will they be able to significantly improve the existing games that they have? And will they be able to implement the strategy around a different development model, right? Around prototyping and around bringing in key creative leads to drive new hit games. And so, to me, that's going to be on this new management team, and whether, so for me, it really starts from here. And, I kind of agree with Eric, and I disagree with sort of the investment banking, the banker's narrative around what's been happening with Glue. And I also agree with Eric that when you look at the new title outlook, the pipeline for, the second half of 18 and 2019, I haven't looked at those games, but, it does seem like it's a little bit risky, based on some of the things that I'm hearing. Anyway,
yeah, you didn't agree with anything that I said, so that's good. thanks for the support.
it's fair.
I like to believe in the I like to be idealistic at some point, so I am a little bit of a dreamer, but I do know Glue's history, and especially with that they've had their Hail Marys twice already. So no, three Hail Marys. So I believe that there's one coming in just when their stock price will go to $2. They haven't released anything in 2 years, and Michael comes in with a banging hit, like top 10 grossing game, and then I can say I was right.
Yeah, I think that is a good point. If you look at the history of Glue, just how cyclical the sort of boom bust cycles are for Glue, this is pretty crazy. But so any concluding thoughts or other points to discuss, Mishka or Eric?
No, I think if you're really interested in Glue, I would just keep an eye on what's going on with Design Home, because that's kind of their The only way they can maintain their current momentum is if Design Home starts to grow again. Tough comps kind of start midway through Q1, and then definitely Q2. And you know, we'll see if they can pull something out. But it doesn't look good from my perspective. But we'll see.
Yeah, and I would say exactly. It's a risky bet on Glue, but they have done it 3 times before. So you know, it's the same thing as. Yeah, go ahead.
And I, what I do love about Glue, and I think this was the old CFO, is that he created a most really, really detailed analysis of their business and provided that to Wall Street. And that's really dangerous for a CFO to do, because then you have to replicate that and the weaknesses are kind of apparent, you know, by the amount of information that you provided, or the strengths for that matter. But so I do love the way they report their earnings and you know, get really deep on that. So I thought that was brilliant of the old CFO.
Yeah.
So it's easy to track. That's what I'm saying.
Where's the old CFO now?
I really don't know. I should have looked that up. I was going to look that up, but I didn't have time.
Well, props to him.
Do we know where Niccolo is now?
He's on a device, some mobile company, mobile, like not mobile gaming, but actually mobile device company. I think they made like a smartphone.
Oh, really? I thought he was down in LA hanging out with the Kardashians.
Oh, that's what we call a parting shot. But yeah, I think they made this big, it made a pretty big splash. It was this mobile device by somebody. I don't quite remember. It was maybe a year ago, but you can Google his name and it will come out, together with one of the OGs from Android phone and so forth. So, you know, they made their device. It got a lot of presence on TechCrunch as always. Glue and TechCrunch work together like peanut butter and jelly, apparently. But anyways, yeah. You should check it out.
So maybe we could close with a prediction, and you know, I think it's bad to try to predict stock prices and things like that, but just to keep things interesting for our listening audience.
Betting lines.
So the stock price is, let's see, trying to find the stock price. The stock price is right under $6, with a market cap of about $820 million. So, Mishka and Eric, maybe we can hear your prediction for the stock price or market cap for the end of 2019.
Can I go first? Because I'll be more wrong. And then okay. So my prediction is that the stock price by the till end of 2019. So we're talking about more than a year, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, given that their stock price a year ago was below $3. I think they're gonna end up somewhere. So it I don't know, it hard depends a lot on the new launches. So I think they're gonna be at $4.50 in 2 years. And in 3 years they're gonna be at $9. It's the cycle.
That's gotta be the worst thing I've ever heard. I mean, that's like the worst prediction ever. I think the stock will be.
That's why I don't work for banks.
I think the stock will be at around four or a little bit below four by the end of next year. Mm-hmm. Is my guess.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually agree. I was going to say $3.50 to $4.
Yeah. By the end of next year. We were all in line with that, but you guys are wrong on the 2 years. That's. I got my money on Mike.
And for the record, after all the Zynga talk, I think there's very, 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 very little chance that anybody would be interested in acquiring this asset, just to be clear on that one.
Got it.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Well, there we go. Twig 14, and I think that's it. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you, folks, for listening to this episode. As always, please do leave a comment. Please do send a note. I personally really enjoy getting all the messages from you. Truly powerful stuff. And please do rate this podcast and subscribe to it, whatever platform you're using. And most importantly, please do keep in mind that all the opinions, literally all the opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and do not reflect those of our employers. So Joseph Kim works at NBC Universal and I work at the powerful Rovio Entertainment, and whatever we say is definitely our own opinion. So that's it. Tune in next week. hope you enjoyed the this episode, and the next one will be always better. Thanks, guys.